Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 374.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about culture, and where we admit that we didn't even try to see Taylor Swift this summer. I just didn't even try. I am your host, Nagin Farsad. I didn't click one thing for 1 second to try to get those tickets. I didn't try and make a connection to some person that's connected to a thing and a venue. I didn't have a conversation about trying. I did not try. And I don't know. I just want to be honest with everyone about it. This might mean that my passport gets revoked. I'm not sure what the consequences are of this vulnerability that I'm now sharing. But I just felt like we should all be on the same page. We should all know. Today, we're not going to talk about that, but we are going to talk about how to cancel plans. We're also going to talk about the really dumb impeachment plan that should also be canceled, actually. And we'll talk about how America is getting really old and that no amount of Botox is going to help the actual underlying problem. I am so excited by today's panel. Turns out these two folks have worked together before, which is always nice when that happens. We have joining us... for the millionth time, is a host of the longest running news pod. It's called The Gist. I've been on The Gist. The Gist is so phenomenal. I don't even know how he does it because he's been doing it for so long. And the frequency is, I want to say daily. Is it daily? It might be.
It's daily. I don't want to say daily, so but I have to because that's accurate.
But it is. Yeah, it's daily. It's wild. It's so much information in this because this man is so smart. I've also had the honor of working with him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me because he's so fucking hilarious and great at all times. It is the wonderful Mike Pesca.
Thanks, Nagin. I want you to know I gave all my Taylor Swift money towards jet season tickets, anticipating a great season, will not happen.
And I am also joined for the first time. We're so excited to have her on. She's host of Time's Person of the Week podcast, which you should obviously be subscribing to. She is the wonderful, the jubilant. And also, by the way, before we started talking, Mike was just like really hard recommending one of her pieces from the 2020 election. So she's a tremendous writer, but again, host of Time's Person of the Week podcast, Charlotte Alter.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. And I also didn't try to get Taylor Swift tickets, but then I had like a 15-year-old girl meltdown about it where I was like, everybody's going but me. And so I'm not as cool about not going to Taylor Swift as you are.
Well, I heard about the movie, I was kind of like, well, we're all going to be taken care of at the end of the day if we need to be taken care of in an era's way. You know what I mean? It'll be fine for everybody involved. All right.
I don't know. That's how I saw Hamilton. And did I really see Hamilton just via the movie?
Oh, yeah. Right. No,
it's like
I see.
It's the pale imitation
Okay, so my other dirty secret. Oh, my God. Today's show is all about me, like, revealing my darkest truths. My other darkest truth is that I've never seen Hamlet. I aspire to see Hamilton. I have seen Hamlet, unfortunately.
Hamilton.
No, but I've never seen Hamilton.
That's right.
Yeah,
Hamlet,
like a little bit
Hamlet
more.
Hamlet did throw away
the
shot.
You could skip it.
Hey, Hamlet, I have some fucking notes, Shakespeare. Come on. No, but Hamilton, I never saw. And it was one of those things where, like, at the peak of Hamilton, which lasted like 2 fucking years, I just like didn't want to be in the getting tickets game. Like anything where you have to try really hard to get tickets, I can't do it. And so I didn't get it. And now it's easier to get tickets. And I just need, now it's just like on a to-do list. You know what I mean? Like I just like need to get it done and fucking, I finally saw Oppenheimer. I don't know if you could read that in my demeanor. But I finally saw Oppenheimer. And I wanted to, did you guys see Oppenheimer?
I did. I was like a little, I was like, what is Robert Downey Jr. doing in this movie? This whole like bureaucratic subplot is so boring.
It felt a little, pasted on.
I thought it was fine.
I loved it. I saw it in IMAX. I thought Cillian Murphy's pores deserved the best acting.
Oh my
That's
God.
How big
yeah.
the picture
yeah,
was.
Yeah, yeah.
Like we got nostrils, we got yes. hairs on the ear, but I loved it. And I also love the fact when you think about it, the flashbacks, the further back they went were in color and the more recent ones were in black and white. So that and the A-bomb are two things that blew my mind.
Wow, I didn't even notice that until you just
you didn't notice
it.
That
no I was like I don't know
that's how they were like helping us keep track.
Oh wait, no, okay, I knew that the Robert Downey Jr. parts were in black and white, but I think I was just so I was so distracted trying
irritated yeah, by
I was
it
just like why are we hearing about this, like it felt like a weird kind of culture war, like knock you over the head with like people are judged by different standards according to the times
right.
they live in. Like, it felt like yeah. a sort of like beat you over the head cultural commentary thing. And I just wanted more about the Manhattan Project.
Well, and I will say, so it's a 3-hour long movie. The middle 2 hours are stressful as fuck. Like, I literally had to go take a break. I told my friend, like, yeah, like, I have to go to the bathroom. I totally have to go to the bathroom. Like, I really have to go to the bathroom. I just, like, literally need to, like, take a little stroll, get some peanut M&Ms, take a breather. Like, I couldn't. And I went to the woman at the concession stand, and I was just like, this movie is really fucking stressful. And I needed a break. And she was just laughing. She's like, I've been working here, like, it for months, and I haven't seen it yet because I feel like it's too stressful for me. And you're now verifying that it's too stressful for me. I shouldn't see it. Like, and I was like, yeah, maybe sit this one out. So even though I fucking know how it turns out, right? Like, it's we know that story. Anyway, folks, let me know. Did you see Oppenheimer? We weren't planning on talking about it. Let's get into topic number one. While I wouldn't quite say it's trendy to opt out and stay in, the tweets, t-shirts, mugs, and art aren't exactly discouraging this behavior either. Says an article that we read on cancelingplansandself.com. Now, do you feel, now, again, like, I would almost say trendy is what I would call it. Do you feel like canceling plans is happening more or less or the same as before? And by before, I mean before the pandemic or before 2010 when the internet exploded or, you know, I don't know, some kind of amorphous before.
It's not happening as much as, I mean, it is happening a lot more than during the pandemic because there were no plans to cancel. That article that you sent around is from Self Magazine and the subhead is, opinion, if you have a packed calendar and a pressing need to practice self-care, this one's for you. And I was thinking a lot about the phrase self-care. Can't we just take the care part and replace it with ish? Self-ish? Isn't most of what's called self-care just being selfish? And out of curiosity, I did a control F. The number of times the word self comes in this Self Magazine article, and, you know, granted, it's going to come on the title, is 31 times. That's way too much obsession with the self. It can be rude depending on how you do it, but I don't know if it's a trend, unless this is the whole thing about cancel culture that they're prattling on about, and I just missed the point.
I don't know.
Charlotte?
I mean, so, okay, so I'm coming at this from somebody who is an introvert who is really good at pretending to be an extrovert. So, like, people meet me, and I'm not shy, and I, you know, and I'm a professional reporter, so I go up and ask people questions, and they think that I'm an extrovert, but actually I'm an introvert. And for me, I think this whole question of, like, are we overscheduled? Can you cancel plans? Is it rude? Is really more of a symptom of, like, making a plan with somebody is like too baked into our social like niceties, kind of. Like, there should be a way to see somebody and be like, or to like run into somebody or to email with them or whatever, like to see somebody in some context and be like, hey, so great to see you. Like, would love, you know, like, love to, you know, love to have you in my life. You're a wonderful person. And to not have that interaction end with making another plan. Like, for me, I feel like we're all so overscheduled because we don't have a way to say, like, hello, person in my life. I care about you. I wish you the best. I like you a lot. I don't want to make a plan with you. Like, I don't want to do it next week. I don't want to do it 3 weeks from now. I don't want to do it in November. I want to continue to have a nice, friendly relationship with you and not have a plan on the books. And that is a-
how do you maintain a nice, friendly relationship with someone when you don't like see them? Because I think what happens with adulthood, like, I think that's what's marvelous about being in school and being in college is that you naturally see people. There isn't very much plan making at all. It's just like happening. Your friendships are just happening and they're happening around you all the time. And then the minute you become an adult, that those like naturally occurring friendships, you know, need to be scheduled. And it's like, so then what do you do?
Well, so, but that's what I would kind of push back on is that I feel like I have friendships, particularly with people who like live far away or something, where it's like, we just text a lot. And it's not, or like, we're like always in each other's Instagrams or whatever. And it's, and like, I still think that we're friends, but it's not so much like, can you do Thursday the 19th? No, I can't. Can you do 6 months from now? Sure. Like, it's not like I'm so kind of.
How's never? Does never
right,
work
like,
for you?
I wish that there was a polite way to say, I love you. I care about you. I do not want to calendarize this relationship.
I did that. I actually pulled
How?
That off.
What is the language? Tell me.
Well, I think it may be helpful to be men of 50, which weren't raised in an emotional culture at all.
Right.
But my friend Jeremy Gittler and I would run into each other every so often, and we'd always have a good time. And then we'd say, hey, that was great. You know what? Let's just run into each other some other time. So one of us, I forgot which one, had to actually broach the subject as a plan. You have to make the plan not to have a plan. Like, hey, how about this? Let's just know that every once in a while, because we have mutual friends, we're going to run into each other and enjoy that. And he said, that's a great idea. Now, I haven't seen Jeremy in about 12 years, so I don't know how well it's working out. No, but seriously, you can do this. It's just very hard. Do you know about the Dunbar number? Do you guys know what that is?
No,
oh, the number of friends. Is that the number of friends?
I think sociologist researcher said, about 150 people is how many human beings can really deal with and conceptualize as real people. And then they become abstractions. And he figures this out by looking at all throughout history and culture. And I do think that's true. I think anything more than 150, it just becomes a name or a slot on a calendar. And unless you plan not to have a plan, you're going to run into oftentimes more trouble than it's worth.
No, so I'm not a canceler. I mean, I think the other thing is, like, so everyone is sort of like just a little depressed. Yeah. And my feeling is if they saw more of their friends, they would be less depressed. But then those are also the same people that cancel. So I just want to say, in defense of making a plan and not canceling, it is better for your mental health if you see people. And you will generally feel better after you see a person than what you felt like when you went into that occasion. So I feel like that's one thing. Also, I think just we're all, I think you're, the way you started out, Mike, is correct. I think we're all together, and listeners have heard me say this before, too focused on how we feel and our own comfort and our own convenience and our own this and our own that. And it's so, everything is about like, fucking, what can I do for me? And like, deliver to my door, and like, don't make me walk to a thing. And like, it's just like, everything will atrophy, your brain, your body, your heart. Everything will atrophy if you continue at that pace. Do not be
totally
so obsessed
agree.
With yourself.
And we have this whole apparatus of solipsism that excuses it and invents words and phrases to tell you that this is the right thing to do. And the never, and the agoraphobic pajama lifestyle is self-care. You know, it's not. Stop. Sometimes it can be. There are gradations and gray areas. But man, are the excuses so easy, or the phrases and the cognitive off ramp so easy to grasp for, and just to tell you, oh, it's all okay. No, you're actually being a selfish person.
Okay, so here's what I think it is for me. For me, I think it's less about wanting to like stay in and be in my PJs and watch TV alone, and more that I think maybe this is something that I'm like clinging to from college, or also maybe this is something because I have like a toddler and like so much of my life is so like regimented around that. Mm-hmm. But, like, for me, the possibility of spontaneity is super important. Like, nothing is more depressing to me than it being like Friday at 4 p.m. and I'm looking ahead to my weekend and I'm like, I have a thing Friday night and then Saturday morning this and then Saturday lunch that and then Saturday afternoon that. And like, you know, and having like every block of my weekend or my like free time kind of like spoken for. Yeah. For me, it's not that I don't want to see people. It's that there is a psychological difference to me between seeing a friend who it's been on the calendar for 2.5 months and I've been staring it down and I'm like, oh God, like this is now I got to go do this. Versus if a friend texts me that morning and said, hey, do you want to go check out this thing at the museum? Like, I would love to do that. And so for me, it's about like preserving, doing that exact same thing with that exact same friend, but doing it in a way that feels spontaneous rather than like.
Well, and also I think you're probably more likely to get that person, that person's like true availability, like emotional, mental, and actual availability. And so and this is something, one of the final tips actually in the piece, which is what I like the most about the piece, was it said, one final tip, embrace quasi-spontaneous plans, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Which is, and these are ones, you know, we ended up doing like a trip to upstate New York to see friends that was like arranged within a couple of days, which is the kind of thing that usually ends up being like weeks in advance and and there's a car and there's this and there's that. And it was so fun. And just the idea that we all happened to be free was amazing, you know? And so that's those are, I think also with parenthood, I end up having to embrace the quasi spontaneous plan more, because it's just like, there is so much that I have to like run around and do for my daughter. Like, you know, but there are nights that I have free or whatever, and I'm a comedian, so that's like annoying. It kind of cuts out a lot. And I also have to keep a lot of nights open for being a comedian. So it's just like the quasi spontaneous plan ends up being some, like a little bit of my saving grace personally.
Yeah. That's where I land as like, that's the kind of plan that I want. Like, I want a plan that is planned within like 72 hours of the thing.
Of a thing. Yeah.
The kinds of plans that I hate that I end up canceling are the ones where it's like, we've all gotten our calendars together and we've decided that like 14 weeks from now, we will have a glass of wine at a bar. Like, nothing could be less fun to me than
that. Right. Mike, any final thoughts on this?
Yes. One is, I don't actually think Charlotte is an extrovert. I think she's given us I don't think she's an introvert. I think she has so many extroverts or quasi extroverts say, but I'm really an introvert. But Charlotte, in social situations, do you lose energy or gain energy?
Lose energy.
Okay.
Really? Really?
I'm saying that because I know the definition of an introvert.
Yeah, you know the right answer. What you are is a good student who is. So I do think that, yeah, there's a lot of time that we're put upon by being in situations we don't want to be in. But I think you might be more of an extrovert. It's the obligation. It's the obligation. It's the bromitment. And once that's on the schedule, that becomes a looming thing rather than, you know, it's probably working on different synapses in your brain.
Yeah.
Where it rests, a different pleasure center. And when it stops living as 2 hours you're going to spend together with a friend and starts living as this thing I have to do 4 weeks from Sunday. So it stops becoming a friendship interaction and it starts becoming this, you know, oppressive obligation. So that's why maybe the 3 day quasi-spontaneity doesn't allow itself to fester in that manner.
Exactly. And it's also like another thing to be on time for, which is the other reason I don't do workout classes, because it's like another thing to be on time for.
All right, folks, let me know what you think. By the way, I like the term introvert and outrovert. So I would like for us all as a country to adopt the term outrovert. Let us move on. We're going to hear actually a quick note about our sponsors who keep the lights on here at Fake the Nation. And when we come back, we'll continue our chatter. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back, and let us step into topic number two. All right. We're going to talk about the Biden impeachment. It's been simmering in the background since Biden took office, but it was always stupid. It's still stupid. But it gained traction yesterday because Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who's the kind of speaker who every day has to worry about being ousted from being a speaker, he is now supporting a formal impeachment inquiry, saying that there is real evidence. Now, if you're like the average person, you're probably wondering, what evidence? Also, what is any of this about? Because it's been kind of... I wonder how it's landed in your ears. I mean, you're both, you know, serious people who read the news and know the news and report on the news. So this may be different to you, but I feel like for the average person, like if I mention it to my mom, she'll be like, what impeachment? What did he do? You know, why impeachment inquiry? So like how kind of like is... How has this landed in your on your radar?
Oy vey. It's so, I mean, he does not have the goods. There is no evidence, no hard evidence to support an impeachment of President Biden right now. To me, this is an attempt by the GOP to essentially create what is their most powerful political, create more of what is their most powerful political substance, which is whataboutism. Like, they just want any bad thing that you can say about the Republican Party circa 2023, which there are many bad things to say. They are politically invested in making it so, in muddying the waters so that the American people believe those same things about the Republican Party. So it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that this is happening after months of Donald Trump being indicted for various crimes, you know? So this helps them to make an argument to very exhausted and confused American voters that, like, both sides are bad, both sides are terrible, you know, Trump's been indicted, Biden's been impeached, everybody's a liar, everybody sucks, because that helps them to sort of excuse what's happening in their own house, basically.
Mike Pesca.
Can you imagine being Kevin McCarthy? Can you imagine having 222 colleagues, actually 221, that's how many, there are 222 Republicans, and at any moment, you can't have more than four of them be upset with you. Because if you have four of them saying, I don't like this person anymore, your job, the one that you've been wanting your whole life, may be over. And also, let me add to that, that of these more than four people can't be upset with you, one is Matt Gaetz, one is Lauren Boebert, one is, right? There's a few wild cards in that mix. So in general, Charlotte is right. Now, I would say, Nagin, your mom says, what is impeachment? Although, why is she sounding like a Jewish lady? but would she say what? Like the what?
That's what, yeah. What, yeah. The Iranians will do a little V on there.
There is a Persian-Jewish overlap, I find.
Yeah, like, indeed.
Hair kinkiness.
Yes, yes.
But if you're in a certain circle of America, you're like, oh my God, thank God it's time for impeachment. I can't believe the Biden crime family has been getting off scot-free thus far. Now, the problem is that circle of society is unrepresentative of the average voter and even the persuadable voter. And McCarthy, and I think Mitch McConnell knows this, and McCarthy must know this, that deep down, the people within his party who are clamoring for impeachment might be so beholden to the part of America that just knows all the narratives of Burisma and Viktor Shokin and every little detail of when Hunter Biden was on the phone and received what diamond from what Chinese billionaire, all things that, by the way, happened. They're so enamored and entrenched in that world, they cannot see that this will blow back to them. I'm not 100% predicting it will, but it is a huge danger. It is a huge danger that the Republicans use their political capital to pursue this impeachment that will either register as nothing because they come up with nothing, or will register as a giant waste of time going against a father who just loves his son with substance abuse issues. So there's this danger in that I think McCarthy knows, but I do think the members of his caucus who are clamoring for the impeachment, they may be living in such a different world, they don't see how it's going to play to the American people. But I will say, that I do think there are more answers that I, as a curious American, would like to know. I haven't come to conclusions yet. I think there is no evidence that I've seen that Joe Biden personally benefited from anything that Hunter did. I think that there is just very weak and tendentious evidence that says that Joe Biden, you know, influenced politics or the American agenda in any way just for Hunter's benefit. But, you know, if there was a more perfect world where Joe Biden didn't have this son with addiction issues, so that's how perfect the world would be. And we could have fair people looking at it. I would welcome all the answers as to why Hunter Biden said on a text message, you know, I've been giving half my money to Pop. I bet it's a decent answer, but we haven't gotten that answer yet. That said, I don't worry about this. I do think McCarthy knows this could be a really stupid mistake.
And the only thing that I've heard is basically in terms of evidence is that there's an IRS, there are a couple of IRS whistleblowers who testified that the IRS slow walked the investigation of Hunter Biden because they because he's the son of the president, and that slow walking kind of ran out the statute of limitations on certain charges. So it sort of like lessened what could happen to Hunter.
Federal prosecutor told me that they never let the statute of limitations run out. That is just either they decide to prosecute or not. So that's a little unusual.
Okay. So then there's that. And then the other thing that I guess a business associate of Hunter Biden's said that Biden stopped by a business dinner and said hi. Do I love that Biden had probably did stop by a business dinner and said hi to his son or whatever. I don't love that that kind of thing happens. What I do think is, though, that probably has happened with like every child of a president since the beginning of time. You know what I mean? Like, I just don't think there's formal legality, right? And being a lobbyist, here's the problem, is totally fucking legal, right? That's kind of the problem. Is that what his job was, a legal job, and being the son of the president is also legal, right? So then both of those things, they exist, they occur. We don't have rules about that. And so that's really the problem. It makes us feel icky, but there's nothing like technically wrong with it. It is icky, right? But it's, unfortunately, that's just like the way it is. It's legal.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with everything Mike said. And I also feel like what is basically happening here is for months, if not years, there has been people there on the right. There has been a sort of like fever dream about the appearance of wrongdoing around Hunter Biden. And there have been all different ways that this has manifested. It's been the laptop, it's been Burisma, it's been, you know, there are various different iterations. And listen, the guy clearly, like, he's got some serious issues. Like, I'm not trying to say that, like Mike said,
he's an upstanding.
Right. Okay. But so like there has been this like pervasive appearance of wrongdoing or theoretical appearance of wrongdoing that they've like really been trying hard to breathe real life into. And what this impeachment inquiry allows them to do is to subpoena documents that could then potentially, depending on what they find, allow them to, they do find real evidence, or maybe they just subpoena a lot of stuff and then they find, like, it allows them to actually dig and get, you know, bank records and stuff like that, which is probably not great news for anybody, you know? So I think that's, if you are, I think Mike is right that it is also very likely to backfire, but also, you know, the other side of this is that it's also very likely to sort of keep Hunter Biden and Biden's impeachment in the news. And one thing that I've learned on over reporting on this, on sort of the way Americans think about politics for many years now, is that there doesn't have to be evidence for it to convince voters. You know, so you can be a very clear thinking, hard headed person and know that there is no real evidence of wrongdoing by the president in this matter. And yet the right-wing media machine is able to construct the appearance of wrongdoing around almost anything. So that's the danger here.
But to their people, I think, to the people who are already plugged into the right-wing media machine, I think that there are certain scandals that people believe that have absolutely nothing to them and really are just fever dreams. And there are certain scandals, like maybe this is a scandal when it comes to Hunter and his behavior. Is it a scandal when it comes to Joe? In a sentence, here's a thing that's not good. Joe Biden was in charge of rooting out corruption in Ukraine. At the same time, his son was working for a corrupt company at Ukraine. That's a fact, and that's not good. That's not good. And I would say Joe Biden did not act with the utmost of ethics in that position. However, the links between Hunter giving anything to his dad or his dad doing anything that helped Hunter. His dad, I guess, could have thrown his body in front of Hunter Biden and said, "You will not take this job." He chose not to do it. His dad called Hunter. He calls Hunter every day. And some of those calls occurred when he was with business associates. But yeah, so there are things of this that isn't like Hillary Clinton drinks the blood of babies.
Right.
There's a little more to it than that. But if they really do, if they subpoena records, and they'll spin records into, they'll spin whatever they find, even if it's nothing, into maybe something if you want to believe. But if it really is nothing, I do think this will redound to their detriment.
Okay, but Mike, I actually want to bounce off something you just said, which is that I actually think Hillary Clinton is a really good example here, because she's also somebody where that she was constantly under investigation, Libya, like there were all kinds of things that she was under investigation for. And most of those things came up with Bupkis when it was, when it was sort of actually rubber meets the road, evidence of real wrongdoing, like nothing. But the constant drumbeat of scandal, scandal, liar, liar, her emails, Libya, whatever, you know, like it has an effect on people, you know. It makes people think, oh, both sides are bad, both sides are lying, both sides have
right scandal. It like attaches to her what it did with her specifically, I think, is it attached to her this kind of like she's a manipulative bad person thing, even though there was no like real, it's like, and then you would say, but why? And then people couldn't specifically relay, but it's just like the drumbeat had done its job.
That's a good example, but of course, sexism and Hillary's lack of skill, she would say lack of skill as a politician, and compare it to Barack Obama. There was no, they tried to, just this last week, Tucker Carlson was interviewing a guy who claims to have had an affair with Barack. Anyway, I definitely don't want to get into it. But they didn't, they couldn't successfully try that with Obama, and they didn't do that with Joe Biden in the last election because the actual information hadn't come to light. So now it does seem to be somewhat correlative, not perfectly correlative and not exactly fairly expressed by the most feverish corners of the Jim Jordan verse, but it seems at least a little bit correlative with stuff that she's done wrong or he's done wrong. Like Hillary Clinton didn't do anything wrong when it came to, say, Uranium One. That was a bullshit scandal. But when it came to using the Clinton Foundation to raise money and also turn around to have some actual power, it's acceptable. It's the way the job is done, but it's also a little swampy.
Right.
So they're worth it, something.
Right.
The email servers, she would admit, was it a high crime misdemeanor?
Great.
Should it have been prosecuted? Comey told us no, but it doesn't seem like the best practices, just like this Biden thing with Ukraine, is certainly not the best practice.
To that exact point, like that is the type of thing that could come up here, though. You know, some little thing that you're right is not a high crime and misdemeanor, but could within the context of the drumbeat of alleged wrongdoing, could still kind of, you know, have a little bit more of an impact than we think.
All right, folks, let me know where are you on this Biden impeachment situation? I'm more curious about, even if it's crossed your radar in a meaningful way, because I know it feels sort of like it to me, it just feels like it's been just like fringe news or like trying to make it into the mainstream news for so long. And like now it's having a moment or whatever. I don't know. I'm so curious. Hit me up. Now let's get into topic number three. So in the last month, we've seen a spate of articles about aging countries. In a Times piece I read, it said that by 2034, there will be more Americans. New York Times piece, not Time Magazine. Just to be clear here, we're with a Times correspondent. Time Magazine correspondent, but it said by 2034, there'll be more Americans past retirement age than there are children. And we've never thought of America this way, but America's really old, and it's getting older. I mean, here's some more interesting statistics. There's an average of 10,000 boomers who turn 65 every day. So the pressure is mounting because all of our social services are not geared towards this volume of senior citizens. So I guess my first question is, what do you think are the consequences of a kind of aging society?
I think we have to raise the retirement age, first of all. Well, all of these stats are based on the idea that 65 is old, but it's not. Those guys are still watching Marvel movies and wearing board shorts.
Right, yes, right. It is 65 true that does not feel old, definitely anymore. It does not.
Yeah. Remember our, you know, forefathers 65 and what that meant? And then we think of the current 65. I don't know. Maybe it's that the most powerful people in the country are in their 80s or about to be, that 65 is seeming particularly spry. I do think, though, in terms of funding our obligations, it is better to have fewer people needing the funding on the retirement end and more people paying into the funding. Absolutely true. But then if you look at societies with huge youth cohorts, like many of the countries in the Middle East, that is a bad formula for success. So I don't know, you know, you hear about the gerontocracies of Western Europe, you hear about the young countries of Africa and the Middle East. Basically, demographers have convinced us that there is no good age cohort that any country should aspire to. And even, you know, China has the one child policy and now they seem to regret it. India has passed them in terms of population. Is there ever a good answer for how old a country should be? I think maybe the best answer is just redefine youth upwards.
But also, I mean, I think the answer to the question is like, what is the best mix? The best mix is that there's more young people who can, there's enough young people who can pay for the aging of the old people. Like, I think It comes down to just that math problem. And the and when you look at a place like Japan, so like Japan is the oldest of all of the Western economies. And they have had to increase the retirement age. Much older people are now working. They've had to add rest areas in like their job sites or whatever, ramps and handrails, because they're just literally having old people do labor intensive jobs. And they're just expecting that like they'll do it and they'll just need a little bit more rest. So they'll probably also be less productive doing those jobs. They've had 450 schools close every year because there's just not enough kids to fill those schools. So imagine the shuttering of schools. It feels particularly depressing to me. It's a money problem, you know, and it's a workforce problem because we need young people to take care of the old people, just literally with labor.
But it's also, you know, I think that this is interesting in terms of what it says about the social and economic conditions that led to this generation gap, right? Because these boomers who are, you know, 10,000 of them are turning 65 every day, they were part of the baby boom, right? So like, what were the conditions that allowed their parents to have so many kids? Government subsidized higher education through the GI Bill. You could buy a house for like $30,000. There were really strong unions that, you know, made it so that a man working a job at a factory could make enough money to support a family of four very easily and also have a car and go to Disney World and take his kids out to dinner. Those were the conditions in which this very old generation of boomers was born. And the reason that there isn't a huge cohort of younger people coming up behind them to, age into these jobs, to grow the economy, to make more money to support them, is because the conditions that allowed their parents to have four, five, six kids have radically changed. And I'm seeing this right now, frankly. There was, you know, I'm 34. I have a almost 2-year-old. And I'm like one of the only people that I know who has a kid, which is which is unusual because I'm 34. I have a college education. I'm married.
What city do you live? Where do you live?
I live in Brooklyn. Okay. So, you know, that's a little, that might be a little young for Brooklyn, but
you're like a you're basically, like, you had like a teenage pregnancy by New York City standards.
Exactly. I always say I'm like a Brooklyn teen mom, but like, but actually that is a huge part
normal.
This question though, is that like, you know, my grandmother, the mother, you know, who my grandmother is of the generation who had the baby boomers, right? Because my parents are baby boomers. My grandmother had her first kid at 19, her second kid at 23, her third kid at like 27 or whatever. By the time she was my age, she had a middle schooler, right? But the reason that she was able to do that is that social and economic conditions were such that she and my grandfather felt like in their early 20s, they could support a family, and nobody feels like that anymore. So it's like, so that's why there aren't, you know, the reason that I'm one of the only people my age who has a kid is not because there's anything special about me. It's because my generation has been like totally screwed by these social and economic conditions, and you can't get a house and you can't get health insurance and everyone has student debt.
I don't disagree with that assessment, but I would also add there's a huge other component, which is women's rights, which like our grandmothers didn't have. And I would say a culture of supporting women in the workforce that they didn't have, and a cultural norm which suggested that women's greatest role was to like pump out babies, right? And so there was all that, those things that gave rise to it. And the other interesting thing about the baby boom, it was unusual. Like, they call it the baby boomer generation because it was a sudden population increase, the likes of which they had never seen before. So we sort of forget, like, the baby boom is also a little bit what fucked us, because if we had gone on a normal path, like, we wouldn't have the population that we wouldn't have such a large population of baby boomers. Just general population numbers would be lower. The boom meant that we had to build a ton more schools that are now shuttering, right? In Japan, the boom meant, you know, that like there's this imbalance. So the boom itself is a problem that has, you know, that's now having knock-on effects for the globe. Mike, my question to you is about migration. So there's countries like China. I mean, China's interestingly fucked because it lifted. And by the way, you were saying conditions. Oh, this is a point I want to make about conditions to have a kid, that they were better for our grandmother's age. Things were cheaper. It was easier. Here's what's interesting. China lifted the one child policy in 2016. They wanted their citizens to have up to 3 children. And they started enticing them with cash incentives, discounted real estate, extended maternity leave, all of that. And none of that was successful.
Interesting.
So there you go with a little bit of help and creating the conditions to make people want to have more kids.
When you say China is fucked, that's precisely wrong. No, I mean literally in terms of procreation.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah, they are not. Yeah. Well, if they were fucking, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Facts are that the economy is greatly correlative with birth rates. And so, Charlotte, you were talking about how you're one of the few people in your neighborhood or maybe in your field or graduated from college, your college friends, maybe high school friends who have a kid. But if you look at women without a college degree, average age of first birth, about 24. Women with a college degree, about 31. So would you advise people not to have a college degree? But But it's a bifurcation of America. You get a college degree, you establish yourself in your career, you put off for logical economic reasons having a baby. And then, you know, about in the 90s, you put it off until your 20s, and then things were fine, and maybe a house was, or a decent middle class, upper middle class life was within reach. Now it's not. So the birth rates in the 90s were increased from the decade before, when economic times weren't as good and the birth rates in the last 10 years have decreased because of the Great Recession and economic times. But also, it's greatly different depending on where you are. There's New York, San Francisco, some zip codes of Brooklyn, lowest ages of first birth, whereas you look at like the Mississippi Delta, but also all throughout the Midwest and all in Texas, very low, comparatively low age for mothers. And that also is exactly, if you put a map of housing costs on top of birth rates, you would see
exactly
that it was almost the same map.
Yes, exactly.
So there's a, yeah, so there's a lot of stuff going on. It's not just generationally, it's just how college education and our social milieu have totally dovetailed. So, you know, people, a college graduate isn't just how much education you have. It's what kind of person you are and what kind of life choices you make. And it's also the affordability is not, it's true in general that things are less affordable, but if you move or live a different kind of lifestyle, maybe a lesser lifestyle, then things become more affordable. Americans are moving so much less than they used to. All these cross trends going on, and I can't even begin to price China into it.
And I wanted to bring it back to migration for a quick second here to wrap it up and get your thoughts on migration. The interesting thing is just to like, I don't know, this is to give us a little pat on the back here in America. We actually don't have as big a problem with replacing our population because we do have migration. Now, I understand that we are shitty in so many aspects of immigration and the refugee crisis and all of that. Now, that stipulated, we are still, doing so much better with replacing our population with migration and accepting migration. And we are, in fact, a country of migrants, right? So it's not unusual for us to do that. By contrast, in Japan, only 2% of the population is immigrants. In India, 0.3%. And China has the lowest, 0.1%. It's almost impossible for a foreigner to get Chinese citizenship. So you think of a country like that. In Germany, by contrast, 17% of the people in Germany were foreign born in 2021. So different countries are having different reactions. And also, like, xenophobia plays into the public policies that they're making. What role it sort of makes me, it heartens me that we have already some sort of acceptance that immigrants come here and they not only replace our population and our tax base, but they help with just the replacement population issue. So what do you think of migration as a solution in the future?
But it seems less a policy and more a happenstance. I mean, Canada does migration correctly. Trudeau says,
right,
we have a goal of 500,000 migrants and they pull in all these people. And, you know, Canada's older than we are, but isn't faced with the replacement problem because their population is growing by conscious choice from their migration policy. Of course, Canada shares a southern border with the United States, and the United States shares a southern border with Mexico. That fact alone, and I'm not even kidding, how cold it is in Canada dissuades a lot of people from going
yep.
there. You know, so I can't magically wish Canada's migration policies on us. We're different countries geographically, but that's the way to do it, I think.
All right, folks, let me know. Do you feel the graying of America? And what do you think about it? Hit me up. All right, that is the end of the show. I'm so excited that you were both on. What a phenomenal conversation. I feel so great having spoken to both of you, and I would love for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all of the wonderful things that you do. Charlotte, where do they do that?
You can listen to Time's Person of the Week podcast, and you can also follow me on Twitter at Charlotte Alter.
Guys, absolutely you should be subscribing to the Time Person of the Week podcast. We all know the Person of the Year cover, and this promises to be more of that feeling. I actually love the titillation, the feeling, the surprise, who is the Time Person of the Year? Oh my God. So I imagine having that same feeling every week with the pod. So what a wonderful conceit. Mike Pesca, where do they find you?
Well, I have the Gist podcast. I have a Substack called Pesca Profundities, and I tweet or X at Pesca Me, P-E-S-C-A-M-I. And I don't want to steal any of Charlotte's thunder, but I was the Time Person of the Year in 2007. This is a visual. I am holding up the actual Time magazine cover with a piece of tinfoil on it that tried to convince us all in 2006, I guess, we were the Time Person of the Year.
Mike,
but I look to this and I get affirmation from it, Charlotte.
I cannot believe that you have that. I can't believe that it's physically there.
And I can't believe you had it on hand.
Yeah.
Like it was within, he didn't get up and leave the room or anything like that. He just like had it. It was like, it was there ready for this moment. It's like he knew this moment was going to happen.
Yeah. Look at some of these. I'm leafing through some of the ads. It looks like this upstart company named PayPal might be going somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, folks, you know where to find me and all things I do, but I want to let everybody know that theoretically I have fully updated my website for the fall, I think. So you will find all of my dates in the fall, and I want to alert Boston area listeners. I'm going to be on the MIT campus doing a free show on September 22nd. The information is on my website, nagin-farsad.com. Click on the events tab and you can see all the information on how to get tickets. But here's the wild thing is it's free. So if you are in the Boston area in Cambridge, come out to MIT on September 22nd. I will be doing an entire hour of The Case for American Exceptionalism by Lady Muzz, my hour of stand-up comedy at MIT. I would love to see you there. We're also doing a live podcast taping of the Reason We're All Still Here podcast at the Green Space. And it's going to be really fun. And it's this crazy, we're going to be looking at Dr. Strangelove and how it is both a documentary and how it has affected so many things since it came out. So I'll let you know more about that. That'll be on October 3rd. I'm going to be doing Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me dates September 27th in San Diego, the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me stand-up tour and September 29th in San Francisco. So you can see me doing stand-up in those cities. I also have other dates coming up, in DC and Philadelphia. So stay tuned for those dates, but they should all now be on my website, which I know has been a problem for myself. And I would love to thank everyone who makes this show a possibility. That's our wonderful producer, Andrew McGuire. Thanks to Gabby Alter for our fantastic theme music. Thanks to everyone at HeadGum for making the show a possibility. If you have any thoughts you want to send to us, please email us at Don't email us at NagineFarsad at anything, because that's not a real email address. Email us at fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. And let us know what you think. Also, don't forget to subscribe at patreon.com/NagineFarsad, where you get really fun bonus episodes of the show, among other goodies. Again, that's patreon.com. Oh my God, I have so many verbal problems today. And I don't know why. I don't know why. What happened? Did I not sleep? It's fucking fall. It's fucking fall. patreon.com/NagineFarsad. And otherwise, we will be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.